This is number 0014, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Yes, it is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, number 0014. And as usual, a full show coming your way. We'll meet William Gladstone, the author of The 12. It's another story dealing with 2012 and the Mayan calendar. But don't confuse it with the movie.
It's not the same story as the film 2012, which recently was released. My version of events for the Mayan prophecy is the positive side of the prophecy. The Mayans predicted the end of the world, but what that means is subject to interpretation.
Tom Reuter has come up with the official rules for calling shotgun. You know, vying for the front seat can be a dangerous battle.
With my group of friends, it often ended in fist fights and wrestling matches and just all about mayhem.
We'll have a check of the mailbag.
Incoming subspace signal.
And there's Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation.
You know what? I know absolutely nothing. I better get on the air with it right away. Hi, this is Steve Walsh. You know, your guy in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. You're going to want to stick around for my two-minute tirade. It's coming up later on, right here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
The guest later on this program, the person who told you it was number 0014, that was Mike LeCouture, one of the news anchors and reporters at Global News here in Montreal. Their newscasts are on at 6 and 11 p.m. Check your local listings for the cable channel if you're here in Montreal. And if you're on Bell Expressview, you can find it at channel 234. That's channel 234 on Bell Expressview. And thank you very, very much, Mike, for doing the slate on this program. A wonderful anchor job you did. Let's get to the Stuff File stories. And there's a story of two guys who was arrested. One who was a criminal and one who was probably just either stupid or bored. In Redding, California, two men were arrested, as I mentioned, one accused of trying to break into Northern California Recycling and another who simply tried to look like the guy who broke into Northern California Recycling. 23-year-old Matthew Padell led police on an hour-long chase, which ended with his capture in a residential neighborhood. But while this was going on, 41-year-old Russell Spade was listening in on his police scanner and heard that officers were looking for a man wearing khaki pants and a San Francisco 49ers sweatshirt. So Mr. Spade wondered if the police would notice him if he went outside wearing the same outfit as the suspect. Well, guess what? They did. And they arrested him. They later realized Spade did not fit the description of the suspect, except for the clothes he was wearing, but charged him anyway with suspicion of obstructing and delaying a police officer. I was going to make this guy the idiot of the day, which comes later in the program, but he's not the idiot of the day. There's a bigger idiot. We'll get to that later. Up next, let's get to the Father of the Year. If you listen to this program on a regular basis, you know when I say Father of the Year, I'm being facetious. A man was arrested in a hospital in Ogden, Utah after allegedly groping a nurse. Adam J. Manning, age 30, wasn't a patient at the Mackay D. Hospital. He had just brought in his girlfriend there to give birth to their child. Manning looked up and down at the nurse and told her how attractive she was, how cute she was, according to a police spokesperson. The nurse ignored him, but he tried to massage her shoulders and then grabbed her breast. She pulled away, but Manning kept after her and allegedly grabbed her again. After the second time, the nurse asked what he was doing. His girlfriend responded that he was drunk. That's when the nurse called police. Manning has been charged with forcible sexual abuse, a felony, which calls for 1 to 15 years in prison. He says he doesn't remember any of it, and his public defender is sticking to that story. He still hasn't seen his child, by the way, which might be better for the kid if he doesn't. And if things go the nurse's way, the next time he sees that child, It'll be 15. Moving right along, we have another story that deals with all things amour, kind of. We go to the UK. This is actually an update of a story I did on the old radio program. A British woman lost her appeal against a ban on her noisy sex sessions after a court heard how her marathon romps that kept neighbors awake sounded like someone being murdered. Carolyn and Steve Cartwright's howling lovemaking sounded unnatural, hysterical, and like they were both in considerable pain, according to Newcastle Crown Court. A 10-minute recording of their sex sessions was played out in court. Oh, that must have been fun for the gallery of reporters, which also heard how she tried covering her face with a pillow to muffle her cries of passion. Neighbors at their home in Washington, south of Newcastle, complained about the noise, as did passers-by and the mailman. The couple were banned from shouting, screaming, or vocalizing at such a level as to be a statutory nuisance, but Caroline Cartwright, age 48, appealed under human rights laws against her conviction for breaching the ban. However, a judge upheld the original conviction and ordered that the banning order should stay. Carolyn Cartwright says she was unable to stop the din. I tried to control it. I even tried to use a pillow to try to lessen the noise, she said. The judge, recorder Jeremy Friedman, rejected her claim. We are in no doubt whatsoever about the level of noise that can be heard in neighboring properties, in the street, and in the back lane, he said. It certainly was intrusive and constituted a statutory nuisance. It was clearly of a very disturbing nature, and it was also compounded by the duration, which was not a one-off. It went on for hours at a time. Now that it's in the court records, that's just bragging, isn't it? It is further compounded by the frequency of the episode virtually every night. Well, there's more bragging for you. We do not find there's any infringement of her human rights in any shape or form. The romps typically started at midnight and lasted several hours, the judge heard. The couple's next-door neighbor, Rachel O'Connor, told court, "It's just quite unnatural. The noise sounds like they were both in considerable pain. I cannot describe the noise. Totally excessive, and I have never, ever heard anything like it. I put my television in my bedroom on as loud as it could go to drown it out." The local council set up special equipment in O'Connor's flat and recorded noise levels of between 30 to 40 decibels, peaking at 47, as loud as a conversation in the very same room. Marion Dixon, a council environmental health manager, took notes which said, "I heard a male voice howling loudly, which I felt was very unnerving." Her colleague, Pamela Spark, called the sounds hysterical, almost continuous, just screaming. "I found it very disturbing, and I noted that it sounded like she was being murdered." Dixon said when the council confronted the couple, Mr. Cartwright held his head in his hands, but Mrs. Cartwright seemed to be quite amused by the whole thing. Well, as you now know, the neighbors were not amused. Not amused at all. And finally, in this section of the Stuff File, on the Stuff File program, here with me, Peter Anthony Holder, you know, you're never too old to enter a life of crime, even if it means becoming a hit person. Elsa Seaman, boy, there's an unfortunate name, age 71, was shot and killed in North Versailles, Pennsylvania, in September when she was mistaken for a prowler. According to police, Seaman had gone to the home of her ex-boyfriend at night and, dressed in black, commando style, was lying in wait in his yard with a pistol intending to kill him. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. A neighbor called in to report a prowler, and a police officer arriving at the scene fatally shot Seaman. So, there you go. What is this world coming to? It's like almost the end of the world. And that, boys and girls, is the segue into our first guest. We are hearing a lot about the year 2012. There's a new motion picture that's out. There are several books on the topic, both factual and fiction. There's one novel that's just out, and it's simply called The 12. It's written by William Gladstone, and he's on the line with us right now. Hi, William. How are you?
Great. I'm here in Beverly Hills, California, and just finished a talk to a group of Hollywood people on the movie that I think will be made of The 12 itself. It's not the same story as the film 2012, which recently was released. My version of events for the Mayan prophecy is the positive side of the prophecy. The Mayans predicted the end of the world, but what that means is subject to interpretation.
So from your perspective, what is that interpretation? And tell us a little bit about what your book, The 12, is all about.
Well, my novel, The 12, is based on real events and actual research. I have degrees in anthropology from Harvard University, and I've spent a lot of time in South America, and I've studied with all of the major experts. And the prediction of doom is actually a relatively small percentage of the scholars who have interpreted the Mayan calendar. My prediction, which I believe is the accurate one, is that the Mayan calendar is predicting the end of a cycle and the beginning of a new cycle. So literally, yes, it is the end of the world as we know it, but that does not mean the destruction of the planet with fires and floods and earthquakes, as this movie depicts. What's also most interesting is that almost every major culture and religion that I've explored has predicted some kind of cycle ending on or about December 21st, 2012.
So tell us, what is the story of your book?
Well, the story is the character Max Duff, who's based on real-life experiences that I had, including a near-death experience when I was 15 years old and was given 12 names. In this near-death experience, and then I promptly forgot the names. In the novel, the fictional Max Duff does remember one of the names. And throughout the course of his life, which includes going around the world for Rod Serling, making In Search of Ancient Mysteries, doing another film, In Search of the Historical Jesus, where he interviews the Dalai Lama and other spiritual leaders, he starts meeting the 12. And the very last name of the 12 is a Native American Indian shaman who reveals to Max that his destiny is to unite these 12 in one specific place at one specific time to ensure the positive prediction of the Mayan calendar end date and not the negative.
Now, you've been in the publishing industry for quite some time, correct?
Correct, yes.
One of the things
a major agent for, you know, Eckhart Tolle's A New Earth. I agented the Dummies book, so I've been in publishing a long time.
Exactly. So one of the things, I mean, we see how trends take off in the book publishing and also in the film and television industry as well, for that matter. In coming up with a book which has a sort of a positive spin on what is set for the future as far as the Mayan calendar is concerned, did you find that you were in an uphill battle when it comes to what people are looking for as far as new books are concerned, especially novels?
Actually, no. I find that the positive side of my story is being extremely well received. The only uphill part of it is that as a novelist, this is my first novel, and therefore I'm not starting from a large base of being well known. Had this novel come out from Stephen King or someone of that ilk, I think we already would have sold 5 million copies. As it is, the novel is doing very well, getting great reviews, and really is being received with great acclaim because it is a positive story and it is based on true facts and is much more likely the actual scenario rather than the doom and gloom, which, you know, I think there's just too many books out about doom and gloom, and I think we've seen enough and heard enough about doom and gloom.
Well, since you've been in the publishing industry for such a long time, why choose this particular venue as your first book, having been in the business for a while?
Well, it actually chose me. I wrote the treatment for the film that will be The 12 in 1979, and I wrote that because I met a woman who had almost the identical near-death experience that I actually had. And that inspired me at that time. Then, as often happens in life, I got busy doing other things, sort of forgot about it, and then 20 years later, met another gentleman who also had a near-death experience in which he had been given 12 names. And that made me realize that this event that happened in my own life really did need to get out there. And I finally got around to expanding my film treatment and actually negotiating with a top screenwriter to write the screenplay. And the very day that we agreed to work together, the Screenwriters Guild went on strike, and I was left without the ability to work on the screenplay. And so as a retreat, I started to work on the backstory of the main character. And it was only at that time, because I knew so much about myself and not about the other people who had these experiences, that I chose to make Max Duff the central character of the novel. And the novel literally wrote itself in about 100 hours, and I had it completed before the screenwriter strike ended. And then knowing publishing people, some people looked at it and they all fell in love with it and said, we want to publish it. Let's do the novel right away. And that's what happened.
What was your near-death?
So it wasn't really my near-death experience, which is described in the novel, The 12. I was given a penicillin shot when I was 15 years old. And my memory of it is next being sort of a conscious awareness in the corner of the room and wondering why there was a loud noise in the room, and seeing this man in a white coat, recognizing that he was a doctor, recognizing that he was upset because the body wasn't responding, and only then realizing it was my body and reentering my body merely to avoid the doctor being upset. No sense of worry about being dead. The experience that I was having was one of complete bliss and surrounded by these 12 energies and names, which I probably forgot when I came to. When I came to, I looked up and saw this doctor above me, and his face went from sheer panic to relax. And when he saw that I was not dead, and he told me that, you had turned completely green, all your vital signs were gone, I thought we'd lost you. So that was a very powerful experience.
So even though it was something that happened to you at such a young age, how would you say that has affected your life after that?
Well, that's really what the novel is about, because immediately it didn't have any effect. In the novel, I recount exactly what occurred, which was, my mother was with me at the time, and we discussed it, and she said, the world is full of mystery, and you may never know if there's any real purpose to this near-death experience, just live your life. And that's basically what I did, and it was only when I met this other woman almost 20 years later that had a similar near-death experience that I felt, maybe there was some meaning to this experience. And for me, at least, the meaning is the release of this novel, The 12, at this particular moment in time. And I do think that the release of the film 2012 is related in that it's drawing so much attention to this date, December 21st, 2012. One of the other really fascinating aspects, which I didn't even realize when I was writing the novel, is that my actual birthday, 12-12-1949, is the identical numerology of 12-21.
Wow.
2012. So that really makes me feel, and that's sort of what the novel's about, all these synchronicities and magical coincidences may have a purpose, and not just in my life, but in the life of everyone on this planet, and that somehow there's a connection and a united destiny for good and not for evil among human beings.
So, by the way, I just recently redid my mortgage for another 5 years. You don't consider me the eternal optimist, do you?
Not at all. I actually think that there's going to be, it's like anything. I have a good friend, Barbara Marks Hubbard, who talks about how emergencies are an opportunity for emergence. Something new and wonderful can come. And I've actually done research on the whole idea of 12. The number 12 itself is a fundamental number. When you come to the 13th note in music, you go to a new scale. When you look at all of the major religions, you have 12 gods of Olympus, you have the 12 signs of the zodiac, you have the 12 adepts of Atlantis. So 12 is a magical number. And there is something very magical about this novel, The 12, that contains certain coded messages that I'm only learning now as I read the novel myself after having written it. And there's really a sense that I have that everything that's going on right now is for a positive end, though there may be some short-term challenges that we all are going to face because we are living in a kind of state of emergency, whether you're looking at the economy or the politics or, just the world situation. But I am, I think, an optimist by nature. But more importantly, I think my optimism is based in sound scientific inquiry.
The novel is called The 12, and people can check out the website, which is www.12thebook, and 12 is numerical 12, 12thebook.com. That's www.12thebook.com. The book is written by William Gladstone. And William, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on our program.
I greatly enjoyed it, and just so you know that it is available in both Canada and the United States at all the major bookstores and, of course, Amazon and all the major online sites. Thank you so much for the opportunity to discuss my book.
William Gladstone, author of The 12. Again, you can find out more information about the book by going to www.12thebook.com, and that's numerical 12, 12, thebook.com. If you go to my website at peteranthonyholder.com, you'll find links to William's website and links to amazon.com and amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You'll find the links on the Stuff File program page on my website in the show with the corresponding number. And of course, that corresponding number for this show is 0014. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, also heard on cyberstationusa.com.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo, is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. You're listening to The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@peteranthonyholder.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook.
And still to come on the program, we'll check into the rules of calling shotgun. Also, a look at the mailbag. Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. And, of course, an idiot of the day. But right here, right now, more stuff coming your way. And we start off with the story of a dog, a very, very big dog, measuring 3 feet tall at the shoulders and 7 feet long from nose to destructive wagging tail. He might be the world's tallest living dog. Owner Karen Weber says her 3-year-old Landseer Newfoundland keeps all 4 paws on the floor when he drinks from the kitchen faucet in the family's eastern North Dakota farmhouse. Take a look at your kitchen sink. Think of a dog drinking out of that while standing on all fours. That's a big dog. Boomer stares into car windows eye to eye with the drivers. That's got to be unnerving. A 20-pound bag of dry dog food lasts the 180-pound canine a couple of weeks. Weber says her furry black and white dog comes into the house and his tail is so high everything gets knocked around. Weber plans to send Boomer's measurements into the Guinness World Records people. The previous record holder was a nearly 4-foot-tall Great Dane that died this past summer. And better be careful next time you lose your dog and think you see him under your car. In Land O'Lakes, Florida, 38-year-old Joseph Canistra was outside his home at about 12:30 a.m. looking for his dog when he thought he saw his pet lying under his car. Oh, there was an animal under his car, all right. Just not a dog. Turns out it was a 5-foot alligator, which bit both of Joe's hands when he reached underneath the car. He was taken to University Community Hospital, where he received stitches on both hands and was then released. The alligator was captured and then euthanized. By the way, no word on the dog. Anybody perhaps look inside the alligator? In Waco, Texas, 24-year-old Trista Joy Lathern had horrible news to share with her husband and friends. She had been diagnosed with breast cancer and would have to undergo the rigors of chemotherapy. She then watched as her friends got together and raised $10,000 for her at a benefit to pay for breast augmentation and reconstructive surgery. The only problem was, none of this was true. Lathern had lied to everybody. Oh, she used the money for a boob job, but never had cancer. So she's been arrested on fraud charges, and on the day of her arrest, her husband, William Lathern, filed to have their marriage annulled, alleging that she induced him to get married by fraud. The couple only married last April, but have 2 sons, age 5 and 3, together. The annulment petition says that William Lathern, who is seeking custody of the boys, says he was coerced into the marriage with the cancer story. I often say after stories like this, there's a special place in hell for someone like Trista Joy. Meanwhile, let's talk about a woman with a more positive attitude on things, shall we? We go to Taipei, which, by the way, is also the home of Keith Perrin, who does the Happy Station radio program. And if you want more information on Keith's program, you can go to my website, peteranthonyholder.com, click on the Stuff File program page for this program, 0014, and you'll find the links to Keith's show and website. Anyway, on to Taipei, as I was mentioning. A Taiwanese woman's ambition to kiss 100 men in Paris has become an overnight web sensation after she provided details of the quest on her much-visited blog. Yang Ya Qing, a 27-year-old music major living in the French capital, has so far notched up more than half of the needed smooches. Her blog features photos of some of the encounters. Collaborators in her project include a factory worker, a model, an Italian tourist, and even a soldier visiting the capital of romance for Bastille Day. "I came up with the idea 3 years ago," she said on her blog. "Three of my four friends who were aware of the plan warned me that I might wind up getting slapped rather than kissed." Yang, who plans to write a book about her kissing experiences, has attracted almost 2 million visitors to her blog. 2 million, including more than 250,000 just a week ago Monday alone. "Aren't you afraid of catching a disease?" one of her followers asked. "No," she said. "The more you're afraid of, the less you accomplish." I've put a link, by the way, into her website. You can find it on my website, peteranthonyholder.com. Again, go to the What's On page or the Stuff File program page for this show, 0014, and you'll find it. Take a look at her website, and I warned you, it is a blog. It's in Chinese. If you can read Chinese, fine. But you can also look at the pictures. But it is in Chinese. I put the link in there for you. Let's get to our next guest, shall we? You know, the rules of Shotgun are officially set. Tom Reuter was tired of people making up rules about who gets to ride in the front seat of the car, so he sat down and wrote the official Shotgun rules to set things straight. Tom's on the line with us right now from Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Thanks for being on with us, Tom. So you felt that somehow the rules of calling Shotgun when heading toward the car needed to be set because people weren't abiding by the rules. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely. It's quite a contentious argument when people are trying to get the front seat before a car ride. And with my group of friends, it often ended in fist fights and wrestling matches and just all about mayhem.
Who the heck?
So we needed something.
Who the heck do you hang out with?
Your average teenage boy is what we were when we originally developed the rules.
Ah, got you. Now, what exactly are the rules, and who's to say, even though you've now officially set the rules, that someone won't contest the rules you've set?
Well, we make provisions for if there are. If there are arguments about the rules or if people want to add their own rules. Now that the rules, we gathered the rules from kind of the public domain. People, everyone seems to have some set of rules, and there's a lot of similarities, and those general set of rules are what we established, and we tried to make them so that they're extremely fair for everyone.
Have you found in any way, shape, or form that the rules of calling Shotgun are regional, and that is that it's different rules for different areas of the country or the continent?
There are. We've gotten emails actually from all over the world, and there are special rules. We had some guys from Canada. We've had to add rules over time because I guess in Canada there are a lot of underground parking places in some of the cities, I guess because it's so cold. So we've had to, we added a garage provision so that once you enter the garage is actually treated as the outdoors and you can call Shotgun as soon as you enter the garage. Mostly though, rather than regional differences, there seem to be technology differences that are emerging among different age groups. In fact, I've heard of people texting shotgun. They claim shotgun by texting it to their friends. And we're going to add a new rule about that over Thanksgiving when the original authors and I get together back in our hometown.
Which is where, by the way?
Steamboat Springs.
So you are from Steamboat Springs originally in Colorado. Okay.
So, I still live here. The other two guys are down in Denver and Boulder,
okay.
Colorado.
So in a nutshell, what exactly are the basic rules of calling shotgun?
The basic rules are pretty straightforward. The two primary things, you have to say the word shotgun, and it has to be audible to the other passengers of the automobile. That's the word. That's how it gets. That's the main name of the game, shotgun. And then number two, the time frame for calling it is very important, and we've decided that the only fair way to establish that time frame is to designate it as immediately preceding the car ride. And in other words, you can't call shotgun for a trip 2 days from now. That doesn't work. It has to be right before the car ride, and it has to be after you've left the building in which you were in to go to the car.
So
you have to be outside, and you have to say the word shotgun.
So in the space between the time you've left the building and you get to the car, that's when shotgun is called?
Correct.
Now, let me put a little bit of a fly in the ointment here. What if you're dealing with a control freak like me? And that by that I mean I'm always the driver of the car. So can't I say who I want beside me?
Well, that is the most common rule that people try to send us. They want us to include that rule, a driver override rule. And we have pretty much decided that that just doesn't, it's not fair. If you're going to play that way, you might as well not have any rules at all, because it's just up to the driver's whim at that point. So all people, we ask that everyone kind of agree to the rule book so that it's fair for the other passengers of the car.
Okay.
Now, if your girlfriend were with the group of people,
right,
she would automatically get shotgun. You would definitely have the right to have her sitting next to you up front.
Now, is there any pecking order or any calling for other seats in the vehicle? Who gets right side? Who gets behind the driver? That kind of thing?
Well, usually, yes. The answer is yes. However, usually people, it's not that they want the right or the left side. It's that they don't want the middle. And so usually it's no one wants, which is commonly known as, and we don't have this in the booklet because it's family friendly, but the center seat in the back is usually known as bitch. No one wants to sit bitch. They want to sit. So usually it's, if one shotgun is taken, the next claim is not bitch. So you can pick any seat except that one.
Okay. So if you yell out NB, can you also yell out window?
Yes. You could call a window seat if it weren't taken.
Okay. Excellent. So not only the thing that's interesting about the site, and by the way, the website again is shotgunrules.com, the thing that's interesting about the site is you also give a little bit of the history of calling shotgun.
Yeah, it's not clear if it's perfectly accurate. We've done some research, and the best that we've ever been able to pin down is that it evolved from the days of covered wagons. And the shotgun seat back then referred to the person sitting next to the driver of a covered wagon, and he would literally sit there with a shotgun in his lap to fend off attacks from unfriendly Native American tribes or bandits or stagecoach robbers, things of that nature, because the driver himself, of course, would be holding the reins to the horses. And he wouldn't be able to serve that function.
So in this modern day of shotgun riding, are there any duties that the person in that job, in that seat rather, has to fulfill, since they're not literally riding with a shotgun these days?
Well, I suppose if you lived in Compton, you may actually need the person sitting up front, but they probably have a Mac-10 or something.
Okay.
But usually firearm wielding is no longer the jobs that need to be. Yes, the biggest one, eating food. If you're going to sit shotgun, it's your responsibility to feed the driver. That means after you've left McDonald's or wherever. You have to unwrap the burger and make it nice and tidy and easy to hold, and then pass it off to the driver. Actually, physically feeding the driver is kind of strange. We tried that once. It's really an unpleasant experience to feed another man French fries.
Okay.
So yeah, you do have to at least put them within hand's reach of him, though.
Okay, gotcha. Now, and since you guys created this, what kind of attention are you getting?
Well, we developed this in high school, and when we were 16, I'm actually, that was almost 15 years ago now that we wrote the rules, and over the years, we have gotten over 1 million hits on our website.
Wow.
We've sold booklets in, because we print a glove compartment size easy reference manual, so you can have the rule book in the car with you to settle any disputes. And we have sold those in 22 different countries now.
How much do they go for?
They're only $5.95, $2 shipping, I think.
Excellent. So besides putting out the official Shotgun Rules, as the saying goes, what are your day jobs?
I'm the editor of an alternative newspaper here in Steamboat. The other two gentlemen that were involved in the creation are both in computer programming.
Excellent. People can find out more information by going to the website, which is www.shotgunrules.com, and I assume they can still order the glove compartment edition for testing and using with their friends from the site as well, correct?
Absolutely.
Again, the website, shotgunrules.com. I thank you very, very much, Tom, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure.
Tom Reuter, one of the guys behind the official Shotgun Rules. The website, www.shotgunrules.com. You can find the link by going to my website, peteranthonyholder.com. Just click on the Stuff File program page for this corresponding show number, which again is 0014, and you'll find all the information. Again, my website is peteranthonyholder.com. You're listening to the Stuff File program online and in many locations, including cyberstationusa.com. Time to check the mailbag.
Incoming subspace signal.
And on this edition of the mailbag, we have a couple of shout-outs, actually based on some emails that I've received, a couple of them, so I'm putting them all together in one mass question, more or less. Many people, and I'm guessing these are folks who didn't hear the old radio show, are asking about the miraculous voice that supplies the intros and liners for this program. He's one of the greatest voiceover announcers on the planet, and his name is Ben Patrick Johnson. He's a very busy Hollywood-based voice god who nonetheless still has the time to be a writer, a model, and an activist. As a matter of fact, if you've been paying close attention, and you know you should be paying close attention because there's always a test on this program, you would have heard his commercial running in this show for weeks now for his latest book entitled If the Rains Don't Cleanse. I gotta tell you, this guy is so talented and versatile and good-looking too that if you weren't so gosh darn likable, you'd just want to smack him. I promise at a later date I will pin him down to being a guest on this program to talk about all things Ben. In the meantime, check out his website if you want to know more about him at benpatrickjohnson.com or visit his MySpace page. And again, Ben, thank you very much for all your help over the years, especially now with this latest venture, The Stuff File. Another shout-out goes to actor-juggler Scott Neary, also in Los Angeles, who was a guest on this program a few shows ago, and who was most instrumental in the redesign of my website. Thanks, Scott, for everything. Your work is most appreciated. You can check out the revamped site at peteranthonyholder.com, and give me some thoughts on what you think of the website, peteranthonyholder.com. It's all brand new on the front page, and all the links and whatnot. And you can check out Scott's site at scottneary.com. That's Scott with one T, Neary, N-E-R-Y.com. And yes, 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 I will put links in on my website so you can find Scott and all the information therein. Remember, if you can't remember those websites, as I just mentioned, but want to check them out later, you can go to my website, peteranthonyholder.com, and check out the Stuff File program page for this show, 0014, and you'll find all the links to everything that's on this particular show. And if you're new to the program, especially if you're one of the folks listening on cyberstationusa.com, don't forget, you can listen to past shows as they are all archived on my website at peteranthonyholder.com. Remember, This is show number 0014, which means there are 13 previous shows that you may have missed, and they all have great guests, if I do say so myself. So check it out at peteranthonyholder.com. You can also subscribe to the shows at iTunes. Plus, for you Facebook users, you can join the Stuff File group on Facebook. That's the Stuff File, S-T-U-P-H, the Stuff File group on Facebook. And that's the mailbag. This is the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, Peter Anthony Holder once again brings you Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. Lock up your daughters, and in West Virginia, your sheep. Joining Peter Anthony Holder is our intrepid embedded reporter, deep in the heartland of the U.S. of A., Stephen S. Walsh.
How you doing, Steve Areno?
Oh, you don't want to know. I just like saying that.
Yeah.
Oh man, I don't know what to say. I'm just in one of those weird moods that hits every now and then. You know how that goes.
Well, I heard in speaking to you a little earlier today that I understand that your computer's a little bit on the fritz or a little bit slow.
Yeah, computer's not working the way it should, and that frustrates me to no end.
I understand. I know what that's like.
I'm managing to get through. I am forging ahead. I am crossing that bridge. I am looking ahead to the next airport. Okay, I'll just shut up now for a while.
There you go. Anyway, let's just get right to it, sir. What do you have for
us
this week? Yes.
Okay, well, let's do it then.
Okay.
Okay, I'll clear my throat here as I usually do, okay?
Yep.
Dateline, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
That'd be the Sooner State.
Yeah, I was there about a month ago, interestingly enough.
I remember.
Yeah, strange things happen when you're in another state and you're wondering what the heck they are that happened.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's not unusual to see a deer or a cow crossing Oklahoma's rural highways.
We're
back. Probably know that.
We're back with the story now, are we?
Yes, we are. I drifted there for a second.
Okay.
But it's very unusual to have an elephant cross a highway.
Yeah. Yeah.
A couple driving home from church nearly slammed into a giant pachyderm that had escaped from a nearby circus. Yes, it was a Republican. didn't have time to hit the brakes. The elephant blended in with the road, said Bill Carpenter, the driver. At the very last second, I said, "Elephant!" Anyway, Carpenter said he swerved his SUV at the last second and ended up sideswiping this 29-year-old female elephant on U.S. 81 in Enid. That's about 80 miles north of Oklahoma City, and I was near there about a month ago. Anyway, so help me, Hannah, had I hit that elephant, not swerved, it would have knocked it off its legs, and it would have landed right on top of us. We'd have been history. That's what he said. Mm. Anyway, this 4,500-pound elephant was examined for a broken tusk and a leg wound. But apparently, the elephant's going to be okay.
That's good to hear.
That's pretty good. I'm always saying, I like animal stories to start off, don't you?
And you know, I think that this guy's better. Carpenter is his name? Bill Carpenter?
Yes.
I think he's got a leg kind of low because, you know, this elephant's not forgetting.
No, they have terribly long memories, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Gosh, they do.
Some other people.
No kidding.
Yeah.
As if. Dateline, Oxford, Ohio.
Oh, no, Ohio. I can hardly wait to say goodbye, oh.
Ah, yes, the Buckeye State. There's that song again.
Yeah, I used to live there. I call it the year of my life I'll never get back.
Do they have a university in Oxford, Ohio, by the way?
In Oxford, Ohio, they probably do, yeah. I think it might be called the University of, that's Miami, isn't it, in Oxford, Ohio? I think it's Miami.
Really?
Miami of Ohio.
Okay.
Yeah, not Oxford.
Now I'm really confused.
You thought, no, it's I think Miami of Ohio is in Oxford, Ohio.
Okay.
You see, it's not Oxford. Now, if you go to Miami, Ohio, Oxford University. I'm kidding. Okay, stop that. Anyway, we concede that there's never anything funny about somebody driving drunk. I'm just saying that to start this off.
Right.
It's my disclaimer. But, it, you know, it's really hard to conceal a smile on your face when you hear this one. In Oxford, Ohio, 18-year-old James Miller was pulled over around 1:30. This is back on Halloween night. He was driving the wrong way out of the entrance to a one-way street, and officers found what was left of a case of Bud Light in the passenger front seat and in the trunk. Speaking of trunks, I think that elephant's doing well. Anyway, the boy registered a blood alcohol level of 0.158.
Uh-huh.
That's nearly two times the legal limit.
Wow.
Also found were multiple Ohio IDs in his wallet. Fortunately, nobody was hurt, and what makes all this so amusing was the Halloween costume he had on at the time. He was dressed as a breathalyzer machine. Here, son, blow! Dateline, Johnson City, Tennessee.
So that'd be the volunteer state.
Yeah, I'm going to go there in another few weeks, just because I'm going to be there
mm-hmm.
in a few weeks. We'll do the show from there. How's that?
Okay.
Cool. Police have arrested 41-year-old Christopher Walls for working a little too hard at drumming up business. Walls allegedly disabled cars parked at area restaurants, then waited for the owners to try to start them. When the cars wouldn't start, Walls stepped in to offer his services as a mechanic and was reportedly making between $40 and $200 a pop. Now that, my friends, is American ingenuity. It really is. You got to love that.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what I would – I mean, were I so inclined, I would disable somebody's car and then offer to fix it. For a fee, of course.
Of course.
Yeah.
Some
not
definite thought –
I'm not so inclined.
Some definite thought went into that.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not so inclined, though.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on.
Okay.
Something a little nicer, shall we?
Okay.
Okay, well, kind of nicer. Anyway, Dateline, Elgin, Illinois.
That'll be the land of Lincoln.
Yeah, Abraham. He lived there.
Or the land of Obama.
Well, it could be that, yeah, but yeah. Neither of them were born there, interestingly enough. The two Illinois presidents were not born there.
Hmm. Well,
one was born in Hawaii, the other was born in Kentucky, and the only president who was born in Illinois, Ronald Reagan, represented California.
Right.
Figure.
By the way, are we sure where that first one is born? Are you certain with that? Just want to make sure.
Probably, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Just checking.
He's pretty safe, yeah.
Just checking.
When he bought... stop it. When he bought his house several years ago, a man found a wall safe in the basement, and he's been trying to get it open on and off ever since.
Did he call Geraldo Rivera?
Yeah, he's had experience with that. Wasn't that an Al Capone safe or something like that?
Exactly, yeah.
Unbelievable. That hasn't worked out too well, has
and,
it?
And Al Capone, that would have been Chicago as well.
Coincidence?
I think not.
You decide.
Yeah.
This unidentified man has apparently gotten frustrated. He hit it with a sledgehammer, as men are wont to do. The safe has an anti-theft device inside, notes the fire department battalion chief in the town. His name is Tim Michaels. When he hit the safe with a sledgehammer in the right spot, the anti-theft device went off. So, when fire department hazmat crews arrived, the homeowner was outside gasping for breath. Apparently, getting a tear gas anti-theft option was available when the safe was bought and installed back in the 1920s. How about that, huh?
Wow.
Boy, that's thinking ahead.
You know, well, I was thinking, that's a real ingenuity, the workmanship that doesn't seem to exist anymore today.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do. I want to booby trap something, you know? I mean, so that... 20 years after I die or something, people who were bad to me for whatever reason are going to have to put up with something nasty. Dateline. This is fun tonight, isn't it?
Yes.
Or today, depending on when people are listening.
Yeah.
Dateline, Appleton, Wisconsin.
That's the Badger State.
Or as we like to call it.
The Cheese State.
Where the motto is.
If it's cheddar.
It's better. This guy in Appleton clearly doesn't understand the concept of a drive-by shooting. Andrew Berwitz tried to shoot up his ex-girlfriend's home while cruising, but he forgot to roll down the car window. Glass shattered all over the place after the shot, and he was quickly traced by police. So there you go. You see, you got the... This is one of those Darwin Awards, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I actually
like to refer to it as a Darwin starter kit, because in a Darwin Award story, the person usually dies, but someone
usually
who does
dies,
something...
a starter kit.
Yeah, somebody
well,
who does...
I tell you, but if I found out, Peter, that somebody tried to do that to me, I'd get really angry.
I understand.
Sometimes, it happens every now and then, usually with people.
Yes.
And what I do when I get angry, though, I don't try to, you know, shoot at people or bang safes or anything like that. All I do is take keyboard in hand and write a 2-minute tirade.
Yes.
And I've done one tonight.
Tirade away.
Okay, it is time for the tirade, and it's based on personal experiences. Experiences that were actually experienced by yours truly. I want to vent about so-called citizen journalists and the regular journalists who screw up in their desire to be first. I shall explain. We recently had an incident about two blocks from the Missouri State Capitol in Jefferson City. Police from the city, the county, the state, the federal government even, swarmed onto the scene of an office building from which a report of a hostage taking had come. I happened to be a street away at the time covering a hearing and was contacted on my iPhone and was instructed to check out what all the police activity was. I did, and I could get really nothing, no information at all, nothing. I couldn't find out what was going on. Nobody would talk to me. So at this point, I called my HQ and told them that I knew nothing but would endeavor to learn stuff. Got a bit of information that I could confirm and went on with it. I went on the air and I also tweeted it using Twitter. I love Twitter. It's lots of fun. You never know who's following you on Twitter. By this time, the citizen journalists and some of the mainstream journalists were reporting that shots had been fired and that a hostage situation was unfolding on the ninth floor of the building. Wow, how exciting. But how untrue. There were no shots fired, Peter, and there was no hostage taking. The details of what happened are still really not completely known, but the only confirmation we got is that police responded to a report of a hostage taking, and I reported that. Some of our affiliates called the newsroom to say they were disappointed that my reports didn't have as much information as some of the other reports they had heard on other stations. We had to tell them there's a reason for that. I reported facts, and the others reported rumors, which turned out to be wrong, by the way. As the citizen journalists, as far as they go, well, they're not accountable because they don't have a news operations reputation to uphold. So, while they don't get a pass, their actions are more understandable. But there's no excuse for the irresponsibility of some of the TV, radio, and newspaper operations broadcasting or tweeting from the scene. Everybody in this business wants to be first. It's a news business thing. We all want to be first. That's a given. But if you're not accurate, being first doesn't mean a damn thing.
Well said, sir. Well said.
Thank you.
Excellent stuff indeed. People want to get in contact with you. There are various ways to do so, as we've since found out.
Indeed.
Go online at missourinet.com. You could also find you on Twitter. People find lots of people on Twitter. I know you're very, very busy, Steve, and you're probably going to go back listening to your Hall & Oates collection. So please... Please say those three magic words.
I can't go for that.
Oh, she's a man eater. Please say those three simple words.
Hit the theme.
This is the Stuff File.
And we're almost done. Just time for one more story, the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
It looks like it was a tragic accident, said Juneau, Alaska Police spokesperson Sergeant Dave Campbell. Investigators say an unnamed 25-year-old man was playing with a .22-caliber rifle inside a home. Do I really need to go any further? I mean, honestly. When someone expressed concern that the rifle may be loaded and thus dangerous to the infant in the room, the man joked that there was one way to find out if it was loaded, and at that point he reportedly put the rifle in his mouth and pulled the trigger. The man was airlifted to a hospital in critical condition. Investigators say neither drugs nor alcohol seemed to be at play in the incident. Well, if it isn't drugs, and it isn't alcohol, it's just one thing. He's an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, number 0014. The website is peteranthonyholder.com, where you'll find information and links on our guests by going to the What's On page or the Stuff File program page on the website. Just look for the corresponding date and program number, and again, that number, 0014. Email me at peter@peteranthonyholder.com. You could also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/PA Holder and Twitter at twitter.com/PA Holder. We hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including cyberstationusa.com. Thanks for listening. See you on the next Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.